UK Wine Show, show number 163. Oregon Wines with David Heddlesheim and Mike Coveney. G'day, my name's Chris Scott and welcome to the UK Wine Show. It's show number 163 for the 3rd of July 2009. Well, the weather here has been unbelievable. I had to buy a portable air conditioning unit so I could sleep well. Yeah, I know, it's a bit wussy, but I don't like it too hot. And with aircon, I'm enjoying our mini heatwave, especially during Wimbledon. Actually, I've had a bit of a problem. After years of nail-biting support for Tim Henman, Andy Murray has got me hooked back on Wimbledon. Hopefully by the time you listen to this, he's still in the competition, but there's a big game on Friday afternoon after we record. Now, some of you may have noticed that last week's show went up on Monday. That's late even for us. I had some issues with our server, the FTP server, so hopefully this week it'll go up on time. But let's get to this week's show. On this week's show, we're having a look around Oregon with David Heddlesheim from Heddlesheim Winery in Oregon, one of Oregon's original wineries. And we're also talking with Mike Coveney from Hilltop Wines. And we find out about the Oregon region and also how they market wines in the US and the UK. In the spotlight, we have the results from our poll. Would you buy an expensive wine in a lightweight bottle? And we're going to find out about those results after the news, which is coming up after our first clue for this week's mystery grape variety. Now, our mystery grape variety yields lots of grapes and reliably high in sugar and performs best in warm rather than hot areas on well-drained hillsides. Sounds like most grapes. Its problem is that it can ripen unevenly and tends to raisin if the conditions are too hot. At its best, grown in the right places, it produces dry red wines with relatively high alcohol, lots of extract and colour, and reasonable acidity and bramley fruit flavours that can develop into rich, spicy flavours with age. Of European origin, this black grape is really seen outside of the US and southern Italy. Now, we're going to give you some more clues after the news with Jane.
Thanks, Chris. Penfolds is trialling a revolutionary glass stopper that mimics the porous qualities of traditional cork and allows oxygen to enter the wine, essential for the aging of fine wine. The trials are in their early stages on just a few cases of the 2006 Grange, and chief winemaker Peter Gago says the stoppers are very different to the Vinolock glass seals, which we've heard about, and have a silicone ring between the stopper and the bottle top. Assuming initial trials are successful, the project will need to be financed by Foster's, Penfold's parent company, but that won't necessarily be known until 2 to 3 years' time once the wine has had a chance to age.
Apparently, the glass is made by sintering. Now, that's a method of making objects from powder, and it's done by heating them up in a sinting furnace below its melting point. What happens is all the glass particles adhere to each other, in other words, they stick. And because they don't melt, small gaps between the powder glass will exist, giving a uniformed, controlled porosity, which allows small amounts of oxygen into the wine in a reasonably controlled way. However, for me, the problem still exists. How do they ensure a good seal between the glass stopper and the glass bottle? In Vinolock's case, they use a plastic O-ring, but I haven't seen any reports on how they manage to keep a good quality seal between the two. What's next, Jane?
Well, sparkling wine triumphed once again at the annual competition for the UK wine industry, the English and Welsh Wine of the Year Awards, and Ridgeview Wine Estate outperformed rival wine producers. A team of 8 Masters of Wine awarded 7 of the 11 gold medals to sparkling wines, of which 3 of these went to Ridgeview Wine Estate. Ridgeview also scooped 2 trophies for Wine of the Year and Best Sparkling Wine for their Knightsbridge 2006, which is a Pinot Noir Pinot Meunier blend. To top it all, Mike Roberts, owner and winemaker at Ridgeview, is the 2009 Winemaker of the Year. There were entries from 7 new vineyards this year, from Kent up to Yorkshire, and they all won awards. A full list of the awards can be found at www.englishwineproducers.com/results.
Mike has slowly been carving himself out as one of the UK's top producers of sparkling wines, and with most of his wines priced at under £20 a bottle, they're also fairly good value. What's the last story about Albarino, Jane?
Well, the Australian Albarino is not the promising Spanish variety Albarino. Instead, they've been supplied with the almost unheard-of French variety Sauvignon Blanc. This is a very different variety to Sauvignon Blanc. The error occurred in Spain back in 1951, when samples were collected for the Ensign collection in Spain. Later, the Sauvignon Blanc that was incorrectly labelled Albariño was passed on to the collection of Vassil in France. And this is where the Australian material was sourced. The problem existed between 1951 and 1984, and Australia may not be the only country affected. That said, DNA testing of New Zealand's Albariño stock has shown to be Albariño. That's all from me this week, but don't forget to visit our website 3050.co.uk for these stories in full.
Cheers, Jane. It is possible to tell the difference between Sauvignon Blanc and Albariño, because apparently the grape clusters and the vines are different shapes. Either way, in the past, Australia's been producing some great Albarinos / Sauvignon Blancs. It'll be interesting to see whether they manage to maintain the market once the wine's been relabeled to Sauvignon Blanc. We covered Albariño a couple of weeks ago in our Mystery Grape Variety, and we'll have this week's Mystery Grape Variety after the spotlight. The spotlight this week is looking at the poll results. The question is, would you buy an expensive wine in a lightweight bottle? Well, the Waste and Resource Action Programme, RAP as we know, has been working with the UK supermarket since 2007 to reduce the average weight of wine bottles and encourage the use of lightweight bottles. The results of this month's poll, compared with the same poll ran in October 2007, show that, in general, wine drinkers not noticed a small but important step towards improving the sustainability of wine through packaging. The poll shows that most people are not aware of the different weights of wine bottles, with 51% of respondents this month versus 55% of respondents back in October 07. Thankfully, those who did notice, 34% this time compared to 29% in October 07, realised that the lighter bottles are more environmentally friendly. Unfortunately, 12% thought that the lighter bottles would detract from the quality of the wine, and that's up from 6% in 2007. But only 4% are worried about the bottle breaking, versus 10% last time we ran the poll. So overall, it's not a big issue for consumers, and this should mean that lightweight bottles will gain consumer acceptance, without them even realising it. There's a link on the wine poll page, which you can get to from the UK Wine Show's homepage, for more information on the environmental aspects of wine bottles. Next up, we have the next set of clues for our mystery wine grape. So here they are. This non-native US variety has all the potential to be a high-quality grape, but it's also California's most common variety and ends up being used to produce a wide range of wine styles, everything from red, white, and rosé to fortified port styles, sweet wines, and even sparklers. That's the last of the clues. Hopefully you've worked it out by now. But if not, have we think about that while we have our interview this week with David Adelsheim and Mike Coveney. David is the owner of Adelsheim Wine, and the link to his website is in our show notes. Let's have a listen to what they have to say. Hi, I'm here with David Adelsheim and Mike Coveney. How are you guys?
Great. Thanks, Chris.
Fine, thanks.
Excellent. We're going to be talking a wee bit about Oregon wines today in the USA, Northwest USA.
Absolutely.
So why don't we start off with just a bit about yourselves, David. Do you want to start with who you are and what you do?
Absolutely. Chris, I'm one of the founding family members, if you will, of the Oregon wine industry. My wife and I started a winery back in, started planting grapes back in 1972 and had our first vintage in 1978. On a European framework, that seems rather as a latecomer, but for Oregon and maybe even the U.S., it was kind of the point in time when the American wine industry was really getting going, particularly focused on fine wine.
Excellent. And yourself, Mike?
Well, I work for a company called Hilltop Wines. We're a bespoke sales and marketing company, and we represent Oregon here in the UK at a generic level. So our role is to develop the profile and raise interest in Oregon wines as a whole.
What is the defining characteristic of Oregon wine, climate and grape varieties?
Right. Oregon is like any place that's half the size of France. You would expect it to have several different regions within it and perhaps even different growing conditions and grape varieties, and that's certainly true in Oregon. Certainly Oregon came to prominence, though, in the 1970s and 80s for growing Pinot Noir in the northern part of the Willamette Valley. It's if there is any knowledge beyond the states of the wines of Oregon, it is it certainly is around Pinot Noir, cool climate, and maybe expanding beyond that to some of the other members of the Pinot family and beyond, Chardonnay, Pinot Gris, Riesling, those kinds of cool climate varieties. But there's always been other parts of the state, both in the east and the south, that have warmer climates and have had focuses on Bordelaise varieties and more recently even on Spanish and Rhone varieties. So it's easy to say that Oregon is Pinot Noir. It's about 50% right, but the other 50% is a much more complex story.
Where is Oregon from a geographical point of view?
I once tried to convince the governor to change the state motto to second one down on the left, but it didn't work. but that is where we are. Of course, you have to exclude Alaska in that and Canada. But no, we're between the state of Washington and the state of California on the West Coast.
Is Mount Rainier near you guys?
It is, but it's not very near. It's in the next state north.
It is in Washington. Yeah.
We have Mount Hood is our tallest mountain. We've got Crater Lake. What we really have is an amazingly diverse climate, starting at the Pacific Ocean, where it's a climate a bit like Britain, year-round kind of 15 degrees C or maybe 20 in the summer, and pretty moist. But once you get over the Coast Range into the Willamette Valley, you have a little bit more, slightly more continental climate, with winters where it doesn't really snow and summers where it gets up to 30, 35 degrees on warm days. Go over a much taller mountain range, the Cascade Mountains, which is the volcanic mountain range, into what is basically a high desert, which is quite dry, maybe 10 inches of rain in a year. And much more extreme climates, very warm in the summer and very cold in the winter.
Do you grow any grapes in the desert? Or desert?
We don't grow much on that side. A little bit along the Columbia River, which tempers the climate a bit. But really, most of the grapes at this point are grown in the valley between the Coast Range and the Cascade Mountains and further south in some of the other mountains.
It'd be fair to say along the Columbia River, there are several appellations, including Walla Walla, which is here over on the right-hand side.
Walla Walla sounds like an Australian wine region.
It is. It is actually one that was moved very long ago from Gondwana land. No, it's it's like a lot of names in the Pacific Northwest, and for that matter in Australia, it's an old name that you Brits changed around when you transliterated it into English, and so it's ended up being Walla Walla.
I've flown over Oregon. I've never actually been to Oregon. I've flown over. I used to live in Seattle for a while, and spent a lot of time commuting between there and California on the way to Australia.
Yeah.
And what always took me was flying over it was how hilly it looked. It always looked like you could never drive there because it was always so full of hills.
Right.
But there is a big valley there.
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, the Willamette Valley was the goal of the Oregon Trail. Back in the 1840s and 50s, we were trying to...
The Gold Rush?
No, not the Gold Rush. In fact, this is actually a pretty important point. Back in the 1840s and 50s, Americans were trying to state their claim to the Pacific Northwest. And so the American government figured out that they could promise people who would get to Oregon free land in exchange for building a house, clearing 5 acres, and living there for 5 years. And effectively, it was a push to push Britain out of the Northwest. And it worked, apparently. You guys were pushed up above the...
I'm a Kiwi, mate.
Yeah. Okay, whatever. Anyway, the point was that this free land was given away, and that was why people came, not because of gold, but because of what was perceived to be the Garden of Eden, a climate that was much, much less extreme than in other parts of the states, much milder winters, much milder summers. And the Willamette Valley is, in fact, an amazing growing region where there are 100 or 200 different crops that are grown, plus all sorts of nursery plants, and it's a huge agricultural area.
What's the breakdown? We talked about different grape varieties.
Yeah.
Pinot Noir, Pinot Gris, Chardonnay. What sort of breakdown?
Because Pinot Noir is what I always hear about with Oregon.
Right.
So is it 50% of production, or what sort of percentage is it?
In terms of production, it's probably at this point right around 50%, maybe slightly over. Because it makes up that much, it is the variety that you hear most about. Below that, Pinot Gris is maybe a third of the production of Pinot Noir, and below that, Riesling and then Chardonnay. Acreage is also in the roughly in that same relationship. Below those four come a huge number of other grape varieties, as I said, Bordelaise varieties, Tempranillo, Syrah, those kinds of things.
Do you grow much non-vinifera?
Virtually none. After Prohibition ended in 1933, Oregon was left with basically no continuity of winemaking. And so the wine industry was slowly reconstructed, starting with fruit wines and non-vinifera wines. But once vinifera was established in the 1960s, it rapidly gained a foothold and has all but pushed out anything else but vinifera.
Now that we've sort of got an overview of the region, where do you sell your wines?
Something around 30 or 40% of the wines are still sold in the state of Oregon.
Yep.
An awful lot of wineries, to say this, there are perhaps 350 bricks and mortar wineries and perhaps 450 brands. All but maybe 120, 150 of those are sold at the winery or only in Oregon. But the larger wineries and those with more marketing understanding and more push to be successful are selling most of their wines outside the state of Oregon. I mean, a winery like ours, which is sort of in the 15th, 16th largest winery in the state, if you will, we're selling less than 10% of our wine in Oregon, but virtually everything else in the U.S. We sell nothing in the U.K., for instance, and only modest amounts in other export markets.
Why is that?
We can.
You don't need to. There's no need to do it.
Yeah.
I think it's fair to say that because of the scale of the industry in Oregon, generally speaking, they haven't had to export. So you do have a large concentration in the state of Oregon, as David says, then outside of that within the continental USA. I think the three most important export markets are pretty much Canada, Japan, and the UK. And we've been focusing an effort on the UK market now for 2 or 3 years with significant results.
And how has the UK consumer taken to Oregon wine? Because it does have some stiff competition.
It does have stiff competition. I mean, ultimately in the UK, we're very lucky because we're the self-elected centre of the wine world, and therefore the consumer here it has the luxury of being able to access wines from every part of the wine-producing world. That said, I think there's huge interest in the wines here. We're very fortunate in Oregon that we have Pinot Noir, and that is synonymous with Oregon. There are many wine-producing regions where, you know, you're not kind of sure where their strength lies within Oregon, and certainly within the export markets. You know, people do immediately associate Oregon with Pinot Noir. As we've seen and spoke already, there are many other grape varieties produced there, but there's a lot of interest in the Pinot Noir, and we can stand shoulder to shoulder with quality Pinot Noir produced in Burgundy, New Zealand, Australia, etc.
Did you get much of an uplift with the movie Sideways?
It's amazing that the movie Sideways was about Pinot Noir in the southern part of Central Coast of California, and instantly Oregon sold out of Pinot Noir, which is an indication of how carefully people associate place with grape variety.
It's true. Well, Otago did quite well out of it as well. You talk to Pinot producers in New Zealand, they reckon they got an uplift from it as well, which is interesting.
Pinot Noir is an interesting varietal because there are few varietals that hold so much emotion in somebody. There's a very much an emotive kind of connection between consumers of Pinot Noir, very passionate about Pinot Noir, and I think that's why something like Sideways kind of ignited that feeling in people and probably had a benefit to Pinot producers around the world.
A lot of people say Pinot Noir is one of the most
You're not going to say difficult, are you?
No, I wasn't going to say difficult.
Oh, thank God.
It is difficult grape. I was going to say, a lot of people say it expresses the climate and the geology very, very effectively. And as a result, how would you define Oregon Pinot Noir?
Pinot Noir really does reflect the place where it's grown. There's no question about that. I think because it's actually a pretty subtle grape, the climate and the geology, as you said, really do have a big influence. As our industry has matured a bit and we've tried to understand what is unique about Oregon Pinot Noir as opposed to warmer climate Pinot Noir as opposed to Burgundy, I think we've come to three things that we can point to at least as a generalization. The first is a rather intense fruitiness in Pinot Noir, but it's fresh fruitiness. So fresh red cherries or black cherries, raspberries or blackberries, not jammy fruitiness. Rather intense, but not over-the-top intense. But also not as much of an emphasis on earthiness and other flavors as you might find in Burgundy, let's say. So Oregon occupies, in terms of fruitiness, a place that's somewhere between Burgundy and Pinot Noirs from warmer climates, whether that's Australia or California. The next thing that I would point to is the acidity that a cool climate gives a wine that we share a bit with Burgundy. But in Oregon, acidity plays this role of keeping the wine fresh and lively on the palate. Compared to warmer climate Pinots that don't have as much acidity and rely a bit more on tannin to provide that backbone, Oregon wines are pretty distinct in that way. So we really, while it doesn't work, if you're presented a wine, can you tell that it's from Oregon? Well, I don't know. But I think we can figure out that if it's Burgundy, it's probably going to have less overt fruit, maybe a little more tannin and acidity, but certainly is a little more austere than Oregon wines would be, particularly in their youth. And on the other hand, warm climate Pinots are going to be closer to fruit bombs and jammy fruit bombs with a little less acidity and maybe a little more reliance on tannin.
What sort of alcohol levels are typical?
Well, typical would be mid-13s. On the west coast of the states, sugar is not an issue. In fact, sugar is an issue almost in reverse. We can often have too much sugar if we wait too long. So we need to be very careful to keep the wines in balance. I mean, everybody in every growing region is going to be concerned about balance, but for us it's different than it would be in Burgundy, where for them getting enough sugar is often an issue. For us, not getting in too much sugar is often the issue.
And ageability of the wines?
In spite of what people might think when they first try Oregon Pinots, they actually age pretty much like Burgundies. 10, 15 years is pretty straightforward for Oregon Pinots. And in that respect, it's the cool climate, I think, that confers that aging ability. The combination of acidity and a lot of fine-grain tannins in our wines, I think, keep them from moving very quickly into old age.
What's the future of Oregon wines, do you think? Because you've got sparkling wine grapes there as well. Pinot Noir, Chardonnay, you know, have you ever thought about sparkling wine, or where are you going?
There definitely is sparkling wine in Oregon. But I think certainly in the U.S., the market for Pinot Noir as a still wine, ageable red still wine, is far greater than the market for sparkling wine, which many people consider a wine for the holidays, and then let's get on to real wine after that. Having said that, the sparkling wines from Oregon, as you can imagine, would be delicious, and there are several lovely versions. But I think the real issue for Oregon is that we are a place that where crop levels are kept very low. The way to cheat Mother Nature in a cool climate, you shouldn't be able to make rich, round wines. And the only way you can do that is by keeping crop levels down at 30, 35 hectoliters per hectare, the same as in Burgundy. That automatically means that the wines are expensive. And so introducing expensive, cool climate wines into new markets like the UK is something that takes a lot of education along with selling and marketing.
That brings on to you, Mike. What is the future in the UK market, do you think?
Well, I see a rosy future for Oregon wines in the UK market, but it's not an overnight success. As David has alluded to, Oregon does not possess large areas producing cheap wine. It is a premium producing area with low yields, and therefore our future will be steady growth. That's what I'd like to see. I think the interest in Pinot Noir clearly will continue, and therefore Oregon should benefit as a result of that. But it's also looking at Oregon within the context of USA as a whole. American wine here, there is a lot of interest in, and we fit within part of that. So I see a very good future for us, but it's one of just continued steady growth.
One last question for you, Mike. Oregon wines, not really common in the shops. Where would someone in the UK get them if they're after them?
Well, there's two things there, Chris. Firstly, if you're looking for more information just about Oregon wine in general and understanding what the state of Oregon is about, then there's a great website, www.oregonwine.org, and that's a great place to learn about the wineries. There's links there to more information. So that's a starting point. In terms of seeking stockists here in the UK, the best thing for people to do is to email me at mike@hilltopwines.co.uk, and I can then share information on where the wines are available. We're hoping that in the coming months we may have some high street availability, but we'll see about that.
Is it still quite a niche online? A lot of wines available online, are they?
Well, there's people like Great Western Wine. They have an online presence, everywine.co.uk. Noel Young, who's a very reputable independent merchant, Wimbledon Wine Cellars. So there's an increasing number of people stocking the wines.
I think we'll wrap it up there, guys. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Chris, thanks a lot for the time today.
If anybody would like to get hold of any Oregon wines and you can't find any on the internet, look up Mike. He should be able to help. A link is in the show notes, but you can just simply look him up in Google or Bing in Hilltop Wines. Next week, we finish off looking at the smaller US regions by talking to people from Washington State. Now, given Dave's earlier description of where Oregon is, that makes Washington State the first one down on the left. All right, almost finished now, but before we finish up, we've got our mystery grape variety. Have you worked it out? This week, it is Zinfandel. Here are the clues again. Zinfandel has all the potential to be a high-quality grape, but it's also California's most common variety and ends up being used to produce a wide variety of wine styles. Everything from red, white, and rosé to fortified wine styles, sweet wines, and even sparklers. It yields lots of grapes with reliably high sugar and performs best in warm weather rather than hot areas on well-drained hillsides. Its problem is that it can ripen unevenly and it tends to raisin if the conditions are too hot. At its best, grown in the right place, it produces still dry red wines with relatively high alcohol, lots of extract, reasonable acid, and bramley fruit flavors that can develop into rich, spicy wines with age. Of European origin, this black grape variety is rarely seen outside California and southern Italy, where it has proved to be the country's primitivo grape. Okay, nothing more to add apart from the quote this week, this time from Estrophanes. Apparently, he's a much-acclaimed comic playwright in ancient Athens, and we're talking 336 BC. But the quote's as true today as it was back then. Quickly, bring me a beaker of wine, so I may whet my mind and say something clever. Until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Chris Scott and the news is read by Jane Scott. To listen to other shows, visit ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.